Hey guys, this is Dave Walker, the Falcoholic Podcast. Had the opportunity to speak with Mike Rothstein, the ESPN reporter for the Atlanta Falcons, after the Falcons season came to a close. It was a long interview, hour and a half, so we're dividing this one up into two parts. This first part will be 30 minutes and touch on a lot of subjects, including Arthur Smith and how he did in his first year with the Falcons. So enjoy this first part of our interview with Mike Rothstein. This is the Falcoholic Podcast. I'm Dave Walker. I'm keeping this intro short because I'm preparing to not be disrupted by the disruptive but great Michael Rothstein, ESPN reporter for the Falcons.
Wait, what?
He joins us again.
I couldn't let you do it. You only because you said it, man. Only because you said it.
It's been too long, man. I'm sorry. I wanted to have you on sooner, but it feels like once the season, and I'm sure you can relate to this, once the season gets going, it feels like it's just this machine that just cranks you out, and you're just sort of doing each week and doing each week. And how was your first year covering the Falcons, Michael?
Yeah, by the way, no, what it really becomes is, it for me at least, it's every day feels like a year, and every week feels like a day. It's a weird phenomenon that I've found since I've covered the NFL, because it wasn't like that when I covered colleges, specifically college basketball, because the scheduling is so different. But when I've covered football and only football, it's always kind of been like that. First season was good. I enjoyed my time. I enjoyed getting to know some people. I enjoyed covering mediocre football, because that's what it was. And hey, that's a step up from what I've covered the last three seasons, so I'll take it. But no, it was fine. I thought I was able to tell some stories that were interesting and different, which is really the only thing. When I say mediocre football, it doesn't matter to me all that much if the team wins or loses. I care more about the storylines and whether people are willing to talk. And at least from the standpoint of some people being willing to talk and share their stories, Josh Rosen stands out, and obviously his trajectory is kind of what it is right now. Who knows what that's going to look like in the future. And Arthur and Terry were both really gracious with their time with me, as well as their families through different points of the year. And oh, wow. Some people around AJ Terrell. So I was grateful for that. And I'm always appreciative of that, because no one has to talk to you. And that's kind of one of those, I guess things that technically they do have to talk to you. They're contracted to, but there's a difference between talking to you and then being able to really open up, being willing to share. And, I think I've said this before, like, access to the players was not great this year. Everything right. was, in scrums. Nothing. I didn't have a one-on-one. I didn't have a one-on-one interview with a Falcons player, at least that was set up as a one-on-one interview, just because of the nature of the beat. And sometimes just not many people being around on a given day, especially because of Georgia's success. Mm-hmm. There were occasionally one-on-one interviews, but very rarely did I have a one-on-one interview with a player. Actually, the two that I had this year, neither, at least in the regular season, neither one of them were with the Falcons. They were with other teams. But so that makes it a little bit difficult to tell some of the stories that I told when I was in Detroit that maybe some people were expecting, but I found other ways to do it. And, that's just part of the job. And luckily, like I said, Arthur and Terry were gracious with their time. Terry and his family talking to me about the plight of their hometown, Lake Charles, where Terry's parents mm-hmm. still live. And Arthur talking to me about a multitude of subjects, but notably one story I still haven't written yet, but I'll write in the off season, but notably about his sisters and their success and being producers in Hollywood, one of them having produced La La Land. So he was
oh, wow.
kind of gracious enough a couple times. Yeah, that ran in November. October, November, sometime in the middle of the season that ran. And, but all that, a lot of times it gets lost in the cycle, like you said, of the season. So sometimes people miss certain stories, and I try to bring them back again toward the end of the year. And I thought it was a good season. I was happy with how it went from my perspective, from being able to do my job. And well, I'm excited to see kind of what year two brings. This off season should be really interesting, much like I think last off season was, although that was jumped in kind of midway through. Mm-hmm. But I'm really curious to see this free agency looks like. I think they have some real big questions to answer in terms of who they're going to re-sign, who they aren't, and what guys maybe they're going to move on from that are on the roster. But how many of those guys can you really move on from? Because they, as of right now, I mean, they added 17 players yesterday as futures guys, but other than that, they had 27 guys on the roster as of, you know, well, technically they still have more, but realistically, like going into the new league year, you have 27 guys contracted that are not under futures deals for next year. So yeah, it's a question of how much can you do that versus not. And some of the really bad contracts that they were hamstrung with. And, you know, I know that's, to me, that's an issue, and that will be an issue. And Terry Fontenot hinted at it. He talked on Tuesday, and I actually asked him, well, how's this going to differ this year versus last year and what you had to do? And he said that they're still going to be under cap constraints, and anyone who looks at the roster understands that because they have a few really big salaries for guys that probably are not deserving of that. And they are going to have tough decisions to make between now and March.
Yeah, you mentioned that. It's I think people forget Julio Jones counts $15 million, or actually I think it's almost $16 million towards the 2022 cap because he has that dead money hit that they pushed off from the post-June 1st trade. And
they still have dead money. I'm going to get the exact number for you now, but they still do have dead money tied in Julio. But by the way, I just, you know, to point that out. So for next year, Julio, he's still on their cap for, let's see.
Yeah, over the cap is saying $15.5
million. Yeah, $15.5 for that's Julio next year. But
that's a big chunk of change.
It is, but here's the thing, right? You had to move on. You had to move on from
absolutely.
It. Absolutely. Move on. And if you look at it, you know, I don't remember if I did your show after that or not, but I certainly wrote it, and I certainly did radio things about it, that I thought that was the best the Falcons could have done. Mm-hmm. And I think they ended up, when you look at it, considering Julio's year, I think that was the best. That the Falcons, I think, won that deal. Now, we'll see what they do with their draft capital, right? Sure. But in terms of the money you would have been paying Julio for the production that Julio did not have, he once again dealt with injuries. That's, what, 2-3 seasons in a row now. So once you hit Julio's age, when you're getting hurt every year, you don't magically not get hurt anymore. It just doesn't happen. So I think that was a really shrewd move by Arthur and Terry to make that trade. And I had said that at the time, that listen, like, this was the best they could have done. Yeah, they're going to lose a really talented player, but it's a really talented player who didn't practice a lot last year. And a really talented player who barely played this year. Now, who knows? Julio might end up going to the Super Bowl. We'll see, because of, you know, he's on Tennessee, and Tennessee's the number one seed. And, you know, maybe he has a brilliant playoff run, and that would be really great for Julio Jones. But Julio Jones had a bad year this year, like by all stretches. I mean,
his worst. By
far. I mean, he played in 10 games, but he had 31 catches for 434 yards. Like, that was his season, and that was the only year that was even comparable to that was when he played 5 games
in 2013.
And arguably last year when he only played in 9 and had 771 yards. Like, that's rough. He only had one touchdown. That's the fewest of his career. He had 48 catches. That's the fewest of, or sorry, 48 targets, the fewest of his career. 31 catches, the fewest of his career. Like, it ended up being a good move for the Falcons to move on from Julio Jones when they did. As much as fans were really angry at the time, but you have to sometimes look at the long view instead of just the short view. And I say that, I'm going to say that again, probably a few times in this podcast.
Yeah, I pulled up over the cap just so I could see what the picture looks like for next year. And I want to get bogged down in that because I feel like there's a lot to talk about that happened in this season. And I just want to ask you this because I have seen a wide variety of opinions on Arthur Smith. And I listened to your podcast on Monday morning, and you had a lot to say about some absurd opinions out there. For those that are listening to this podcast, go listen to Mike's podcast, From the Perch. especially the one recorded after the game against the Saints, where he answers questions, because he has a lot to say towards the end of that podcast. It's a good listen. Definitely recommend it. But Arthur Smith, I have literally had people directly tell me that he should be fired right now. And after
I've
1 year,
too.
Yeah, it blows my mind. I've seen people who have, you know, a reasonable take where they're like, it felt like he did what he could with the roster, and others that feel like he overachieved. Where do you land in that spectrum? I know you're not on the fire him spectrum.
No, come on. No, I mean, I've covered disasters.
Yeah,
I've covered disasters. This was not that. This was, I thought, a really good coaching job. I made an argument a few weeks back that if they had somehow snuck their way into the playoffs, similar, frankly, to what Nick Sirianni did in Philly, mm-hmm. that if they had snuck their way in, I thought you could have made an argument for Arthur Smith to be coach of the year in the NFL. Now, realistically, does Zach Taylor or Mike Vrabel probably get that, or Bill Belichick? Yes, I think so. I voted for PFWA. I don't know if we're allowed to disclose these or not, but I just will. I mean, I voted for Mike Vrabel for coach of the year from PFWA. And, like, but you look at what Arthur Smith did with the roster that he inherited, the salary cap issues they had. That team is not a deep team. It's not a particularly good team at a lot of positions. They were clearly flawed, and they cobbled things together. They beat the teams they're supposed to beat. What happens is that people, fans, very often forget what your expectation was before the season.
Yeah.
You get in this, and that's reasonable. Media does it too. But before the season, the expectation for this team was at the most 10 wins, I think, and at the least like 3. Mm-hmm. And really, the reality was probably somewhere between 7 and 8. Between 7 and 10 and 9 and 8, I think, where most people fell. And that was with Calvin Ridley.
Yes.
100%. That was with Mike Davis, who was productive. That was with more Dante Fowler, who was better than the Dante Fowler from a year ago. And none of those things happened. Calvin Ridley didn't play. Mm-hmm. Dante Fowler had 4.5 sacks this season and was not good in a lot of other times, and basically became a part-time, almost pass rush only player by the second half of the season.
Yeah, his snap counts dropped a good bit.
Dramatically, because he could, because he's not a good edge setter. And, you know, people critique Stephen Means for all they want, listen, he didn't produce a lot either, but they trusted him on the edge because they knew he could set the edge. The same thing with Brandon Copeland, same thing with James Fox. And Adia Ogundeji, I think, had the best season of any outside linebacker, which is a good thing if you're the Falcons, because he's your one guy, to me, that you know is back for sure next year. So all of those things, 7-10, not bad. Mm-hmm. 7-2 in one score games, you take that. You know, now some of those, were they lucky or fortunate? We use that word. Yeah, they were. The Saints, the one against the Saints in New Orleans specifically, because you know you don't get that big kind of break down the sideline by Cordero Patterson, and I don't know if you get in field goal range because New Orleans' defense is really good. We saw that again this past Sunday. So. Yeah, I thought it was a good coaching job for what he had to work with, for what DMPs had to work with. Like, you can't create pass rush out of thin air with guys that you have. And then, by the way, also, no one expected Isaiah Oliver to be particularly good in the slot. He ended up being very good in the slot, and then they lost him.
Right.
And you wonder what the defense would have looked like had he had him for the whole season and what that would have changed. I feel like Richie Grant and Jalen Mayfield actually were in very similar positions this year. In that they were being asked at one point in the year to do something that they were not maybe drafted to do. And in Jalen Mayfield's case, I think that was go out and try and play tackle, because they didn't know what was going to happen in Caleb McGarry's case in camp, and they needed to be prepared. And then I think that stunted his growth at guard. And then Josh Andrews gets hurt, and he's not supposed to even start at guard. And then, you know, he ends up starting base. He plays every game, you know, except for the last one, because he's hurt. Like – Okay, I mean, but that's you're playing a rookie there, and rookies are up and down on the offensive line. They are, and again, a third round pick, not a first round pick. Richie Grant was your second round pick, but no one, you should not have expected Richie Grant to play a lot because of who they had in front of him as vets. And Isaiah Oliver was a strong nickel, and they were working Richie Grant really at safety and some at nickel. And then when Isaiah Oliver gets hurt, you have to scramble, and all of a sudden you're playing three rookies. That's what people don't get. There were three rookies who basically were their nickels this year. A second-round pick in Richie Grant, a fourth-round pick in Darren Hall, and a fifth-round pick in Avery Williams. Avery Williams was spent like Avery Williams was probably going to be the guy before the season. You're like, he's going to get the second-most playing time behind Kyle Pitts because of he's going to win the returner job, at least the punt returner, and have a major role on special teams. Like – Darren Hall, to me, I mean, remember, he was inactive when everybody was healthy. And he was a guy that I think they were going to maybe start to play in the second half of the season as like a special teamer, and they needed him. And I thought he acquitted himself well to the point where it's going to be really interesting to see whether he wins that job opposite A.J. Terrell next year. So, like, all of these things, right? And I know we're covering a lot of ground, but all of these things, to me, are like, you got to understand, like, when you look at the wins and losses, sure, and listen, I'm not saying Arthur Smith is a perfect coach. Not in the slightest. Like, there's some time management, game management things that left me scratching my head. There were some sort of, you know, personnel decisions that left me confused. But from a scheme standpoint, I mean, there were some times that they felt kind of predictable. But also, again, you look at what they had to work with on offense. And, I mean, are you going to throw to Tajae Sharpe 10 times a game? No. You had two guys on your team, realistically, by midseason, you had two guys on your team that you feel comfortable targeting eight or more times a game. And that's Kyle Pitts and Russell Gage. You couldn't even count on targeting Cordarrelle Patterson eight times a game. You could, but when you start using him as a full-time running back, like there's only so many touches you can give him. And we saw that towards the end of the year, where, in my opinion, he – got beat up a little bit because he never played that much. He'll never admit it, but he didn't play that much. And you saw it in the production in the last few games.
Yeah.
I mean, he talked on Monday and it was mentioned that he only had four carries in the finale. And he was like, really only four? Like, which to me tells me, well, you know, he's like, yeah, then he's like, well, I'll play whatever they want. And he had a decent amount of snaps, but that to me tells me how like, his body had been through a lot that year. If he doesn't realize he only had four carries.
And he's 32. I think people forget he's on the opposite side of 30. So,
yeah, no, he's an older guy. Like he to me is a very fascinating free agent decision for the Falcons. And we'll see what they do. But yeah, because he'll be 31 in March and he doesn't have the wear and tear that other guys do. Right. But he's still over 30, and for a running back, that's old. For a receiver, a speed guy, that's old. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But, you know, you look at it – so you look at his snap counts from game to game, from year to year, right? This was the third highest snap count he had played in his career, highest since 2016 in terms of offense. It's the first time he's played over 25% of offensive snaps since 2017 when he played 43% – against Oakland. He played 22% in New England, then played 19% in Chicago in 2019 and in 2020. Like, that's what we're talking about here. I mean, in one season in Atlanta, he has already had he had the second most snap counts of his snaps of his career with the team. Like, now granted, he's bounced around a little bit, but I mean, that's what you're looking at when you're looking at Patterson and what it's been for him. And I mean, that's just kind of the reality of what you're looking at is that it's a lot. It's just a lot. And I mean, I don't know. I thought he played really well for what they wanted him to do, but you know, can you count on that again next year? I don't know the answer to that question. I really don't. And I'm not being like facetious in that. I just really do not know the answer to whether you can count on that totally. Like, I mean, here's the truth. His snaps, since we're getting into this a little bit, he his snaps every game except for – there were two games where he had under 20 snaps this year on offense. There were the game against Dallas where he got hurt,
mm-hmm.
and then the finale. Everywhere yeah. else, he has had a minimum of 23 snaps. In this back half of the season, other than those two games I mentioned, his minimum was 25 snaps. And he had over 30 for three straight games when they were still in it. So, yeah, I mean, that's a lot, especially in the back half of the year.
And those last four games, his productivity really seemed to fall off. Except I think he did okay in Buffalo. I think he had over like 40 or 50 yards. But it seemed like the last four games or so, his productivity sort of took a major hit. And to your point, for a guy that's heading into his age 31 year, the big thing here is like, if you bring him in for $1 million, like that's a different conversation than if you're paying him $5 million a year. And that's the kind of decision-making that Terry Fontenot is going to have to make with the tight salary cap. Is Cordarrelle Patterson at 31, is he going to be able to last 17 games with a high snap count? And is he worth $4 to $5 million, whatever he's going to look for on the market? And I think that's, to me, that I know fans want him back because he is, he's very entertaining. But I think from a financial standpoint, he's one of the biggest wild cards, I think, for this team right now.
Without a doubt. To me, this is just to me, but, and again, this is just me guessing. And me looking at this, if you bring Cordarrelle Patterson back, you're probably moving on from Mike Davis, and you're giving Cordarrelle Patterson that Mike Davis money, and you're probably, if I'm the Falcons at that point, I'm looking at drafting a running back somewhere and making that the guy, because we know Arthur Smith wants to run the ball. That's mm-hmm. clear. And without a good run game, what he wants to create is going to be much more difficult. Because he's not a pass, he's never been a highly pass oriented coach. And we even saw that this year, right? Like a lot of the pass depends on play action and this, you know, what you're working with. So I look at that and I say, well, what do they need to do? Well, you can't have your running back group can't be Mike Davis, Cordarrelle Patterson, and Quadri Olison again. It can't be. No. Now, could it be two of those three guys? And a rookie who's maybe your number one back? Yes, I think it can be.
Yeah.
But it can't be those three guys.
Yep.
Like, I it just can't. And that's not a knock on any of those players. Mike Davis admitted it on social media. He called it the worst year of his career. And it was. And he was frustrated. And it's really – I mean, Mike Davis was a pleasure to talk to. But from a product, and he was honest when he said, yeah, I'm not producing like I want to. He would say that throughout the course of the year. But from a reality standpoint, when you're looking a team that's looking at the salary cap situation that they are, you have to make really difficult decisions. And they're going to have really tough decisions to make at a lot of spots.
Yeah.
And to me, a guy like Mike Davis, can you pay him the amount of money that he's going to make next year? Which is not an, let's be clear, it's not a massive, huge, insane amount, right? Like, mm-hmm. let's just be very honest about that. But his cap number is $3.25 million next year. And you're paying him $2.5 in base salary.
Yep.
Like, can you really, you know, you move on from him, it's $750,000. And, like, in dead money. And at that point, I mean, that's $2 million. That's possibly two one-year contract veterans. That's maybe another running back. That's mm-hmm. maybe a third to almost maybe half of what you might pay Patterson if you wanted to go that route. So it's a tough conversation to have. And you know, it's uncomfortable conversations to have because we're talking about guys' livelihoods, their jobs, their families, as we've seen the other day when so many coaches get fired and people, you know, celebrate coaches being fired. And listen, those are decisions a lot of times that are decisions that have to happen. But people always like, I hate when I see people celebrate guys losing their jobs or getting fired because there's so many other factors that go into it from a livelihood standpoint and families and kids. Like, I mean, so I'll just share this. I mean, so Bob Quinn gets fired, right, in Detroit. Like, I got to know Bob Quinn's kid, one of his kids a little bit, just because his kid works in the equipment room a lot. And I spent a lot of time with the equipment staff. And for a story I wrote in 2019, back when we had access to these sorts of things. And so I would see him and I would see him around the facility, and, you know, we would talk and I'd say hi and we'd be friendly. Like, I felt terrible for that kid, because it's not, he's around that facility all the time. He knows all those people, you know, and it's not his fault. And then you go to school and you know, you're hearing it at school. And then all of a sudden, you know, you don't know what the situation is when your dad loses his job. Well, am I going to have to pick up and move again?
Yeah.
Am I going to have to, you know, and it's the same thing with players too. Like, there are players who will move their entire family when they go from one place to another. A couple guys on the Falcons that have done that have bounced around a few places and take their families everywhere. And there are others that their family stays put and they basically live on their own for 5-6 months. It's, and either way, it's tough, but like, that's just the reality of the NFL that a lot of people don't see and don't think about. And it's just the truth, and it's hard. But, you know, people don't want to worry about that when they celebrate somebody being fired. And listen, a guy can be fired for performance all they want, and that's a fair assessment. But, like, chill on the, like, celebrating people being fired. Like, I've always been cognizant. Or I would say, like, the last 10 years or so, I've been cognizant of that.
Yeah. It's dehumanizing. And I know the sport is, just in general, sports can be just brutal in that aspect. But it doesn't mean we have to participate in it.
Yeah, I didn't mean to get off on a thing there, but yeah.
No, you know what? This is what I like about you.
That's why when I see it, but also, like, have reality. I mean, I know I talked about this on my show, but have reality when you're talking about moving on from a coach. Like, there are people who want to fire Arthur Smith after 4 games. No, some of them are trolls on social media, and you're like, you know, just what are you doing? Like, you do realize if you fire a coach after 1 year, A, that sends a message, especially one who did the job that Arthur Smith did this year. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like he went 1-16. And, you know, and it was supposed to be a 500 team. You're like, oh, wow, this is bad. Like, no, I mean, you do realize that if you do fire a coach after a year, or even after 2 years, if it's not gone terribly, like, the other coaches see that. They see that, because the owner or the GM, well, what does that mean? Why did that happen? Because maybe I don't want to go there if that's going to be the quick hook that I might have.
Yeah.
And also, it doesn't promote stability. Why do you think the good franchises are good no matter who the coach is overall? I mean, look at Green Bay. Green Bay cycled through a few coaches, and largely when they have a down year, they have one down year and then they're fine. Why? Because there's stability in the coaches, there's stability in the players, there's stability in the program, and the coaches that they've had have built it to such where there is that stability.
Mm-hmm.
That's valuable. I mean, look at Pittsburgh. They've had 3 coaches, like, in the last longer than both of us have been alive. 3.
Yeah.
Lions have had, like, 3 coaches in, like, the last 5 years. But, you know, I mean, but, like, the Browns have the same thing. Like, at some point,
Jacksonville,
at some point you need to move on. Like, and Minnesota is a good example of that. Like, Mike Zimmer, I think, did well there, but and Rick Spielman as well did well there, but it kind of ran its course, and that happens. It happens for almost everybody, but, you know, unless it's that situation, that's fine. That was 7, 8, 9, 10 years, however long was he there? He was there, I guess, 7 years. Like, that's a long time.
I thought
it
was longer than that, but yeah.
Well, 8 years then, whatever it was, like, that's pretty good. So I look at that and I say, okay, that's fine. That's stability. Like, you can't be firing coaches 1 or 2 years all the time, because all you're going to get is you're going to have to cycle through a whole, you're going to have to roster churn, cycle through the whole roster, turn over most of the roster. And then what? Then you're going to fire that guy once he maybe gets his players? Come on. Like, that's just, it doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't.
Like, why? I don't know. Like, I feel like some people are saying it just to be controversial. Like, what do you do? Why? All it does is just make you look silly. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. Sorry. Yeah. You know this because I've talked about it multiple times this year, whether I've talked about it on Twitter or talked about it on my podcast. Like, I just don't understand it. Like, why they're doing this. Like, and here's the thing. Atlanta fans can't even be mad anymore. Like, you're not – Atlanta fans, I'm sorry. You're no longer allowed to be mad. You just won the World Series. If you like Georgia, most like Georgia, you just won a college football national championship for the first time in 41 years. Your basketball team went to the Eastern Conference Finals. Like, you want to know who would love any of that success? Detroit.
Yeah, yeah.
Cleveland. Like, stop. Like, you're in a good run right now. Like, have some patience.
Yeah, yeah. What, 1 year is not enough.
2 years. I would argue 2 years isn't enough based off of the salary cap situation.
No, they inherited a mess. I don't think anyone would have said differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're looking minimum 3 years. Minimum. Mm-hmm. And that's only if it goes really poorly.
All right, guys, that's it for part one of the interview with Mike Rothstein, the ESPN reporter for the Atlanta Falcons. As you can tell, a lot of thoughts about this Falcons season, about the coaches. In part two, we will talk about the Falcons rookie class. We'll also talk about some of the big cap hits and decisions that the team may have to make about guys like Grady Jarrett. And yes, Falcons quarterback Matt Ryan. So stay tuned for that. You can find Mike on Twitter at Mike Rothstein. And of course, his articles at ESPN.com. And as for you guys, you can follow me on Twitter at FalcoholicDW. Updates for this podcast at FalcoholicPod. And of course, our articles daily at Falcoholic.com. This is Dave Walker. Thank you guys for listening in. We'll talk with you next time.